Welcome back to the Gadget Show podcast, where we dive into the latest and greatest in the world of tech, gaming and gadgets.
Yeah, today we've got a fantastic guest, someone who knows the gaming world inside out. He's a tech journalist, gaming expert, all-round industry insider and editor-in-chief of Maximum PC Magazine. So we welcome Guy Cocker.
Hi, both. Hi, Jason. Hi, Susie.
It's great to see you. You've been a tech journalist for many years now. So first question, really, how has the industry changed in terms of journalism over the years for you?
Wow, big question, Susie. Yeah. obviously, you've got the big evolutions through online. I started my career on a home cinema title, which was just a magazine, and sort of the long lunches with PRs and sort of, you know, being able to sort of take Friday afternoons off are certainly a lost era now. We've gone through sort of online and now into sort of the influencer and now kind of coming into the AI era, and everyone certainly at Future we've partnered with OpenAI in sort of an attempt to unravel this kind of either exciting or daunting new frontier. So yeah, I think that's the thing that's on journalists' minds at the moment, is how is AI going to either assist or end our careers. But I think optimistically, you know, we're starting to use AI tools, and we cover them a lot on the title that I edit, which is Maximum PC. About
that is a Faustian pact. Can I just say that you have got into bed with the devil, my friend? You've hooked up with the people that are most likely to end the human phase of journalism. You're actually working with OpenAI.
Well, obviously, way above my pay grade, Jason. But yes, we've made a business partnership with OpenAI to provide our content and receive revenue in exchange. But yeah, I mean, in terms of AI, I mean, there's lots of. If you look a couple of years ago during when everything was in lockdown, the focus was on cost of living and trying to, you know, use your PC to either cut costs or, you know, be able to buy things cheaply. But now it's all about, you know, how to use AI tools. And some of them, I don't know if you two have been using them. I mean, you obviously covered them on the podcast before, but they've gone from, I guess, kind of ethereal promises to now being actually tools that are pretty useful. So I edit a podcast for Maximum PC, and you know, we do lots of B-roll of videos, or B-roll. Should I explain B-roll? I guess like just the cutaways to products when we're talking about them. So AI tools that I was at CES with Intel, and they were showing me, you know, how you can just create B-roll by just locally as well on your computer by just putting in prompts and saying, you know, I just need a shot of a PC, and that really helps with kind of the video editing process, which is really good. And then we don't use we would never use AI to create content, but just because we worried about what Google and other search engines would make of that. We're still unraveling all of that. But we do use them to help kind of prompt ideas for what sort of things our readers might be interested in, or, you know, being able to just use AI on the fringes for idea generation can be really useful as well. So I don't know if you guys are using it much in your journalism or your...
I just used it last... but this sounds like a setup to a joke. It's true. I used it last night because I do a little quiz on a Sunday night, right, called Way of the Exploding Show. And it's like a pub quiz. There's about 70 of us and we've been doing it since lockdown. And I realized, I used to say, because I'm old school journalism sort of vibes, right, broadcast media kind of mindset. So I would say, you know, episode 47. Yeah, that would be my title. Mm. You know, Way of the Exploding Show, episode 47. And then I suddenly clocked that things have moved on. No one cares. What I need is a hook, right, about the quiz, okay? So I went, last night I went to the AI, to GPT for Omni, and I said, you know, blah, blah, blah. I asked it that question. What it came up with, a whole load of them, but the one I used was 99% of you will get this wrong, ... And honestly, I had more viewers than normal.
Yeah, kicks in, doesn't it?
It does. So yes, there's a good example. What about you, Suze? Do you use it as you travel the world?
No, I haven't used it, actually. I don't use it for work. I don't know where it would benefit me, actually, because I write all my own stuff, obviously. I mean, I would say I write my own
right
stuff.
There, that's where it would help you.
Yeah, I don't even but I don't write it, so here's my problem. I don't write a script for MotoGP because I don't know what's going to happen. So I'm broadcasting live from the heart. We are talking about what we're seeing, income, outcome, input, output, And there is no scripting really for that. There is, like, at the top of the show, you know, you'll have some imagery of a country and the track, and you put in some stats. I could use it for that, but I don't, because I know it, and I'm a bit, you know, defiant with not using it. I think, you know, that's probably the take for quite a few people, maybe, or maybe I'm in the minority. I don't know, but I don't really see how it would particularly ease my life at work, actually, at the moment.
I like the fact, Guy, that you and Future, who I don't know if you know, but I used to, also used to work for way back in the day.
I think everyone at this stage kind of magazine, has or will do work for Future. Yeah, the big fish. Yeah.
PC Gamer, I did a couple of pieces for them. I think it's fantastic that such an important voice in the UK tech scene are still clearly doing well. And it's interesting to me, actually, that the whole sort of corporation have welcomed OpenAI. You know, it doesn't need to be them, does it? Could be anyone. Very, very interesting. I mean, I'm kind of playing with you a little bit. I do get it. I understand. But yeah. Can I ask you something about gaming specifically? Because you're such a big gamer.
Of course. Yeah. And can I just address that point? Because I think it is an interesting discussion point for the industry. I mean, it is. I mean, when you mention this kind of Faustian pact, it's obviously difficult. But when you can either sort of join the technological trends and get ahead of them, or you can kind of be left behind. But I think from a wider, with just speaking of myself and having been in publishing for 20 odd years, sadly, that, you know, it's kind of, you saw what happened with when publishers gave up to the kind of Google algorithm. What Google and Facebook and all the other big tech companies did was they sort of took that content and hosted it behind their own walls. So there's a platform called AMP for Google, which serves news from Future and most other publishers. And then Google gets to take that traffic and some of the ad revenue, and they share it with publishers. But, you know, that really was quite destructive for the industry. So it will be interesting to sort of see where AI goes. I think there's a lot of consternation between content creators in general, not just major publishers, but just content creators, that their content, which they have to pay to make, is getting gobbled up by this AI machine. So I think it's an interesting one for as publishers about what you do about this AI thing, whether you get on board or whether you get left behind. I certainly, on a personal level, admire a lot of publishers that just stick behind a paywall and just charge users for their content. There's obviously a lot of publishers that do that well, like the New York Times.
And I know you're not being personal. I understand the statement, but you clearly in the context of publishing. But I like Susie's stance, actually. I think it's interesting, because I also think that, you know, sort of like vinyl being an example, or, you know, freshly made barista brewed coffee, there is absolutely a place for actually eschewing those developments and being a kind of no AI zone. So it is absolutely fascinating, and people are taking different stances, aren't they?
Well, I just think, like, Susie, it's quite an impressive stance, because, you know, even just in when using Google, you get the top result now as an AI produced result. When you're typing an email, you press tab to kind of finish the sentence automatically, and then at the bottom of my prompts, I have Gemini because of a phone that I bought. So Gemini saying, do you want to make this more familiar, or do you want to make this more formal, you know, depending on who you're sending it to. So I think we've hit the tipping point where it's actually quite difficult to avoid some of these AI tools now.
And AI generated content, obviously, it's, you know, it's creeping into games now. Do you see this? How do you look at it? Do you see it as an exciting evolution, or is it a potential issue?
Well, I think, you know, like you were saying, it's the value in what you do for your motorsports coverage is in interpreting as a human what's just happened and giving some sort of editorial slant to that. I think video games, like movies, are a creative endeavor, and I think if you're using AI too much, and we've already seen people falling foul of this in some of the Marvel shows where they've used AI to create some of their intros, they've used AI in The Brutalist to improve improve the accuracy of some of the Hungarian accents, and, you know, there's a negative backlash to that. I think for smaller studios, some AI tools might be really helpful, because they can't afford to employ a script writer, and they may not have that experience to be able to do that. It's quite a specialist skill. I just think at the moment, and things are improving, obviously, but at the moment, you can really tell when something's AI generated, whether that's dialogue or whether it's content in general. When we've done tests at Future and certainly on Maximum PC, there's an air of sort of, if you ask something to rewrite this review in a more kind of funny tone, you can really tell, or I think anyway, as a professional editor, that it's AI generated, and I just don't want anything to do with it. So yeah. I think it offers opportunities, but it might not be quite there yet to be able to write you an entire game. But I'm sure there are examples that are out there on Steam.
With that in mind, then, do you think that we're in a shakedown phase, I'm going to call it, because, you know, it's quite new, and like you say, AI generated some content is really obvious, which this is what I think, and I see and I hear broadcasters, and I think you lifted that off as crap. It's bullshit. It's because you're not a very good broadcaster. This is why I'm a bit dogged about it. But do you think that we're in a shakedown phase where eventually that will kind of settle and AI will then become more useful?
The stage that we're at now is AI is really impressive and obviously come on leaps and bounds in content generation and just answering questions about, you know, where the, like I used it when I was in Montpellier in France the other weekend, and I was out there just for the weekend and I wanted to get some bread to take back with me, some French pastries, and I needed to find a boulangerie that was open on Sundays and within kind of a, you know, half a mile radius, and AI was really good at that. I think in terms of the content generation, like we said, it's you can kind of spot it a mile off. But where AI is at, and I think this is going to be an interesting development over the next few years, is we're at the sort of not dumb AI stage, but you give AI a very specific task and describe it really well. It can do a lot for you. The next phase, and I don't know when this is going to come in, is going to be AI that can kind of improve itself. And obviously, you've got quantum computers that are coming in that might be able to help with some of this. But AI that can improve itself can obviously kind of improve exponentially, and that's, you know, we're getting into the sort of realms of sci-fi here, but that's whether that's 5 years off or 50 years off, I don't know, but yeah, that will be when it's a real challenge. And actually, going back to Jason's sort of vinyl question, my optimism around journalism is that I think that with so much AI content out there and so many unscrupulous publishers out there that will just say write 1,000 articles about whatever the new TV show is or whatever the new Nvidia graphics card is, I think there will be a move from the audience that cares about quality journalism to go, okay, we want this human verified, and we want
there
to
always
know
is
that. Yeah, so that actual quality,
since the 70s I've witnessed that you know, the tide comes in then it goes out, and you know, the balance is addressed. Can I just generalize things now? I'm interested in, you mentioned that you went to CES. I'm guessing that you meant this year's 2025 in Vegas. Any
already booked in for next year. I'm so excited.
Have you really?
I love that show. Yeah.
Is there a piece of tech that you've tested possibly at CES or in the last, let's say, 6 months or year that really surprised you? So something that you were like, wow, this is a bit of a category changer or a game changer.
I'll be totally honest, Jason, like, no, because, you know, I'd say a category changer or a game changer is something like the iPhone, or I mean, you could possibly call AI a game changer, obviously, and the market seems to be going crazy for AI, and all the valuations of these companies are going sky high, so I think the industry thinks that AI is the next big thing. I think this year's CES, sorry, in January, so a couple of months ago, the piece of tech that I really liked was from Lenovo. They had a laptop that had an OLED screen that would go from a kind of standard, I'm looking at mine right now, so standard widescreen
format. You've got one?
I haven't got one. No, I wish I could. It's going to be released later this year, but I don't know if you've seen it. It rolls out.
We actually talked about it in this podcast just before you came on. Isn't that funny?
It's cool. Yeah, I think that was a, but it's technology like that where you walk away and you go, oh, that's really cool, and that's like that. But I think that's possibly one of the problems or one of the challenges as a journalist and also just being a fan of technology is there's been a while, I would say, it's been a good few years since we've had something that's genuinely been a real game changer. CES tends to be the show of ever-growing TVs and, you know, just rollable TVs or see-through TVs. Obviously, robots as well, androids that will kind of help you around the home. I mean, it's probably something big coming in soon from... I mean, you see a lot from the likes of Sony and Samsung and to a certain extent Tesla as well. But yeah, I mean, it's really, there's always stuff to cover in technology, and there's always stuff to cover, like, you know, Tesla, to mention them again, they're losing a third of their stock value as Elon Musk gets into politics, you know, potentially that seems to be the result of why their stock price is sliding. But yeah, the next big thing is always kind of difficult to pin down.
I think you're right, though. I think it's some form of domestic home help robot or the industrial version of that is, relatively speaking, inexpensive to roll out en masse, and only because I was very convinced by Elon Musk's chat. I think it was Joe Rogan. I can't remember where it was. Mm. But the kind of penny dropped where he said, look, you think cars, you know, make a good business case. Robots take that concept to the next level. Mm. So what he effectively said is that my cars are robots. And as they drive around, they are soaking in all of this input. And that input is being, you know, computed and used to train Grok. We now know that you can, I think it's an NVIDIA platform, isn't it, where you can train robots in all the fine motor skill maneuvers in the box, as we say, so within a computer virtual environment. So a lot of that training is now being done without need recourse to go outside. And so these robots, when they arrive, are going to be fully trained, and they're going to be motor skill aware, environmentally aware, because of the input from things like Tesla, but they're not the only source of data in the universe. So I do think it's going to hit hard and fast, and as long as they're affordable. I mean, who wouldn't want, you know, imagine if you're you know, if you have, well, I have an elderly mom, God bless her, and you know, people of that sort of age need a lot of physical help, and they also need companionship. And I'm not saying that my mom should substitute me for a robot, but you get my point. Not everyone has a son or a daughter or a home help or the money that it takes to, you know, to be supported. And robots could provide a really, really powerful way of helping an ever aging community. So I think it's, That's going to be, in terms of, I did sort of go grand, didn't I? I said category changing technology. That would possibly be it.
Yeah, the next big category, it will be coming and could be robots. I think, to me, one of the big things is going to be self-driving cars, and whether Tesla or Uber figures out the technology, I think the legislation, at least in the US, is going to change to allow it to happen. And then you're going to have, essentially, if I've got a Tesla or any other car that supports this technology on my, you know, on my drive, I can then let it go out and be a taxi during the day and earn me money. And there's loads of interesting concepts there. I think that it's a bit of a downer note, but I think that it's, certainly in the PC space, you know, Nvidia have just released all these new graphics cards that aren't particularly impressive in terms of the generation on generation improvement, but they've charged a lot more for them. They've increased the price of their sort of Halo top level card by $400, £400. And I think that's that's the theme of the moment, is the sort of a sense of malaise in the tech, certainly in the PC tech industry, where you just, things aren't improving very much. So Moore's law is out the window. You're getting price gouged all the time beyond even already rampant inflation. I think there's a certain sense of, we're a bit sick of this, and we don't, you know, we're not going to upgrade this cycle, which, you know, is probably of concern to the manufacturers.
Mm. You're kind of covering an area that I wanted to talk to you about. So gaming media, obviously it's evolved massively, you know, with YouTubers and streamers basically taking over. What is your take on the current landscape?
Well, I think it's really interesting. I think I edit Maximum PC. I've edited Stuff magazine and GameSpot before that, and then CNET. So I think the challenge was that we would bring on new talent, new younger talent, and we would train them up, and we would, you know, teach them how to, not in all instances, but, you know, train them how to video edit or write. And then they would see the opportunities either on YouTube or doing a Substack newsletter or whatever it is, and they would leave. And so there's this sort of talent and brain drain. And I think, you know, working at a lot of publishers these days, particularly some of the newspapers, has become just, you know, covering whatever's big on Instagram that day or Twitter, and it's become, you know, do 10 of these stories a day, and it's a drain. It's an absolute, it's not something that I would want to do personally. But I think that I don't know if this answers your question, Susie, but I think that there's always that potential for people to leave and go and do their own thing. And I think to be frank, it's much more lucrative for talented content creators to go and do their own thing. So I think that it's a real challenge for publishers to hold on to their talent. Added to which, I mean, it's not connected to technology, but you're seeing, you know, new media owners, some of the tech conglomerates, so Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post, dictating the editorial policy of what they can write. You know, they can't do now cartoons that I'm going to get the words wrong, but sort of challenge whatever the political status quo is. And some of those writers and cartoonists are the superstars of their, you know, they're why people subscribe to that platform. So they will then go and leave, and the media will just become more fragmented. So it's a bit of a downer to talk about, but I think that's yeah. realistically what's happening.
We move into sort of autocratic areas, don't we, which is what we're seeing on a daily basis, I think, increasing. It's interesting. But I think, you know, more and more, we've all done it. We're like, why is that news? You know, you see some breaking news, you're like, that's not even news, let alone breaking news. But with big, I think, you know, this has stemmed from sort of my question about gaming media evolving, which you answered, and we sort of moved to news. So shall we move back to gaming?
We probably should.
I'll tell you what, can I ask you about retro gaming? Because we love the whole retro scenario on the Gadget Show podcast. And actually, I would say that it's our biggest area. When we talk about anything retro, we get a fantastic experience. And I think that we're getting a better experience now than we would have done if we'd been doing this 5 years ago. Because I think people are, you know, really embracing retro in across the landscape, from vinyl through gaming and everything else. So what kind of classic console or game do you think deserves a proper comeback?
Oh my gosh, what a question. My gaming history, so I was born in the 80s, so I remember games like Sonic, playing those in my youth. Unfortunately, I'm throwing my parents under the bus, and they never let me have a games console. They always got me like a Commodore, Amiga, or Commodore 64, because, you know, my dad, bless him, wanted to sort of teach me programming, and he programmed these little maths games for me. At the time, I had no interest in playing them, but of course now I'm like, that's such a sweet thing of him to have done. I sort of really became of age sort of with consoles like the Dreamcast. So I don't know if it's a particularly popular game, but there was a really sort of trippy visual and audio game called Rez, which is probably still my favourite game. I don't know if either of you've played Rez.
I think it's we might have lost Jason temporarily, and I'm sure he will have played it.
I was thinking yes. I think Jason would probably have played it, but it's the closest I've kind of come to as a sort of video gaming auteur. There's this guy from Sega called Tetsuya Mizuguchi, and he's updated Tetris. So there's a game called Tetris Effect as well, which came out a few years ago. He's all about kind of the visuals and the audio coming together, and he made these kind of, sounds a bit strange, but these sort of vibration feedback packs that you could put on your body to kind of get into this game. And it was, you know, at the time in the 90s, it was quite
like making
revolutionary.
It 4D almost.
Yeah, exactly. It was a very sort of like trippy experience, and I think a lot of people really leaned into that. But that's a game I'd love to see updated. I think that this sort of trend towards retro is again something we see on Maximum PC, and at Future, one of our biggest titles is Retro Gamer, and it's amazing to see, while there is now no official Xbox or PlayStation magazine, and magazines are challenged in general, actually one of our titles that's doing really well is Retro Gamer, because that makes sense. It's sort of people who are perhaps a little bit older wanting to replay the games from their past, and sort of people that still buy magazines. So so yeah, that makes sense to me. But yeah, we've just run a feature on how to play arcade classics on your PC. I think for me, the absolute ideal, the thing that, to answer your question, the thing that I would absolutely love, and I think would feel like I've made it, is to have one of those classic pinball machines. I grew up by the sea, and I loved playing pinball pinball games in the on the arcades in Filey, which is where I was born, on the Yorkshire coast. And but my friend in America, who obviously American homes are much bigger, he has one, and it's an absolute nightmare to just keep maintained. It's a, you know, yeah, the parts are really expensive. You often need to call someone in, an engineer, to be able to fix it. So it'd be an expensive hobby, but that would be the thing that I would love the most personally.
Oh, so if anyone wants to start a new business, maybe there's an idea there to play retro games. But in terms of retro, like, why do you think it's such a big growing area? I mean, you did touch on it there. There's an older generation, and I'm going to throw myself in there because I was born in 1970, actually. So I've gone through this whole iteration of gaming and physical gaming, digitals and everything. But do you think it's because, as people get older and the world slightly moves further away from them, they want to get back into the sweet spot of maybe like when they were happy when they were kids, or just doing something to kind of take themselves out of the world?
Yeah, I think there's a few reasons for it. One is, as big as the video game market becomes, and as many children of all ages and genders who are now playing video games. When I was younger, it felt like a much more male pursuit. There are still a lot of people out there that just wouldn't like touch a traditional video game. And I notice it anecdotally. You know, if I have a friend or a partner and I'm like playing something like The Last of Us, which is this incredible narrative game that's now been made into a HBO TV series, I'm like, I want to say like, look, come and look at this. Look at how amazing this game is. Look at how well written it is. Look at how amazing it is visually. And I'll tell that person, and they'll go, yeah, like, you know, tell me when you're playing Sonic, or, you know, like, I'll play that because the controls are easier to understand. It's easy to just play 5 minutes of it and put it down again. So I think there's a lot of people out there that just aren't really interested in the medium, but they are interested in some of the games that they might have seen when they were a child. I think there's the other thing of, I've got friends, you know, who work at the major tech companies. I'm seeing one of them tonight, and he loves vinyl as well, but his kind of vinyl equivalent is for video games, is to go to Japan and go and buy plastic stuff in the hope that, you know, he can collect it, I think in the hope that it goes up in value as well. But he wants to have that authentic gaming experience in his lounge on his big TV with his Sonos sound system. But he'll buy equipment from, you know, from China. He'll go onto AliExpress and one of the Chinese websites and import like a scan converter to get that kind of authentic look, you know, how video games used to look with kind of like sort of deinterlaced graphics. It all looks really retro. And again, I think it's a, like you said, it's a reaction to maybe how overwhelming or complicated life can be, and it's a callback to simpler times. And then I think, yeah, I think there's the other element. You're getting more people who are actually video game historians and collectors, and it has been traditionally there's been a lack of gaming archival. So, you know, it can be really difficult. You might remember a game from, you know, your childhood in the 80s or 70s, and you just can't play that game anymore. It's not supported on an emulator. You can't find it. It's gone out of circulation. And I think that some people really want to bring those games back, and certainly Good Old Games Online is the only one I can think of which are really preserving and helping to preserve gaming libraries and make it less complicated so you can just install a game and play it. I think one of the biggest frustrations to me of gaming is just that feeling of, you get your friends over on a Friday night, you boot up your PlayStation, you want to play FIFA or Call of Duty, whatever it is, and it's like, oh no, you've got to download a patch, so you've got to sit around for like an hour while this thing downloads, and you know, the settings you can use to mitigate some of that stuff. Whereas back in the day, you just press a button, you'd be playing a game 30 seconds later, and it's sort of it's harkening back to that period.
Yeah, ease of use in the sweet spot. Guy, thank you so much for your time. Before you go, just tell me, like, the most excited you've been about a game or a piece of technology. Can you take us back to that moment where you were blown away by something?
Oh yeah, so that's a big question. The one that springs to mind is getting my first student loan when I was at Sheffield University, and going straight out that first day and buying it would have been a PlayStation 2 at the time. And going out and playing Gran Turismo, and just spending all of my time playing Grand Theft Auto when I should have been studying. I think that's the time when technology got me really excited, and I still get that sort of that tinge of excitement when I see something cool. That's why I'm so obsessed with going to CES and seeing what's new and what's next, and just being one of the first to see it. But I think that moment. There are other moments like driving a Tesla down, like, that have been part of my job, like driving a Tesla and having it go into the auto lane switching and having it drive itself on the motorway. Those moments, obviously, using the first iPhone, those are the moments that stand out to me, where you're just like, I mean, using Spotify for the first time. That as a tech journalist, I've gone, oh, this is cool. And figuring out mental ways. How could I, if I lived in this Tesla, could I afford it? Those sort of moments where you're just completely blown away are one of the reasons you do the job. And it's wonderful. I'm sure you have the same thing.
Yeah, but yeah, absolutely. It's making me smile. It's taking me back, actually. I started to think about some of the things that are so simple, but they blew me away. Just like using Skype for the first time. I remember thinking that was incredible. It sounds stupid now, but those are the moments, aren't they? Perhaps after
They're shutting Skype down, sadly, aren't they? They're
it's the end of the Skype era, I suppose. It's been superseded, hasn't it? By everything else. Yeah, so what's happening for you now? What's coming up? What's on the horizon?
So obviously the highlight is doing the Gadget Show podcast, but after that I am doing a we're doing covers on the new Nvidia graphics cards, which I mentioned. So we've done one, the performance of this new £2,000 RTX 5090. Our current cover is an RTX 5080. One of the other things that's really big, not with me but with my friends, they all love building these PCs that are super compact, like a games console almost. And the new Nvidia graphics cards, at least the ones that Nvidia produce, not the partner cards, are actually quite small. So you can fit them into a very small case. And so we've done a cover on how to build a super small PC that you can either tuck away, hide away under your desk or behind a monitor, or you can use it like a games console, which is a thing that is undeniably cool. But I like building PCs that are quite big and you can do lots of stuff with them. You can add in other cards as needed and upgrade them. It's really easy, but there's certainly a big market of what are called small form factor PC fans out there. So that's what we're doing on the magazine, and then we'll move on to the latest AMD graphics cards as well, which for PC fans it's a pretty exciting time.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely fantastic. Guy Cocker, thank you so much for your time. Speak to you again.
Thanks.